Chapter 13. She looked so plaintively lovely as she proffered the request, so trustfully sure of his sympathy and understanding, that Treanor felt himself wishing that his wife could see how other women treated him, not battered wire pullers like Mrs. Fisher, but a girl that most men would have given their boots to get such a look from. Out of spirits? Why on earth should you ever be out of spirits? Is your last box of Dowsett dresses a failure, or did Judy rook you out of everything at bridge last night? Lily shook her head with a sigh. I have had to give up Dowsett, and bridge too. I can't afford it. In fact, I can't afford any of the things my friends do, and I am afraid Judy often thinks me a bore, because I don't play cards any longer, and because I am not as smartly dressed as the other women. But you will think me a bore too, if I talk to you about my worries, and I only mention them because I want you to do me a favor, the very greatest of favors. Her eyes sought his once more, and she smiled inwardly at the tinge of apprehension that she read in them. Why, of course, if it's anything I can manage, he broke off, and she guessed that his enjoyment was disturbed by the remembrance of Mrs. Fisher's methods. The greatest of favors, she rejoined gently. The fact is, Judy is angry with me, and I want you to make my peace. Angry with you? Oh, come, nonsense. His relief broke through in a laugh. Why, you know she's devoted to you. She is the best friend I have, and that is why I mind having to vex her. But I dare say you know what else he has wanted me to do. She has set her heart, poor dear, on my marrying a great deal of money. She paused with a slight falter of embarrassment, and Treanor, turning abruptly, fixed on her a look of growing intelligence. A great deal of money? Oh, by Jove, you don't mean Grice? What do you do? Oh, no, of course I won't mention it. You can trust me to keep my mouth shut, but Grice P86 greater than good Lord, Grice. Did Judy really think you could bring yourself to marry that portentous little ass? But you couldn't, eh? And so you gave him the sack, and that's the reason why he lit out by the first train this morning. He leaned back, spreading himself farther across the seat, as if dilated by the joyful sense of his own discernment. How on earth could Judy think you would do such a thing? I could have told her you'd never put up with such a little milksop. Lily sighed more deeply. I sometimes think, she murmured, that men understand a woman's motives better than other women do. Some men, I'm certain of it. I could have told Judy, he repeated, exulting in the implied superiority over his wife. I thought you would understand. That's why I wanted to speak to you, Miss Barker rejoined. I can't make that kind of marriage. It's impossible. But neither can I go on living as all the women in my set do. I am almost entirely dependent on my aunt, and though she is very kind to me, she makes me no regular allowance, and lately I've lost money at cards, and I don't dare tell her about it. I have paid my card debts, of course, but there is hardly anything left for my other expenses, and if I go on with my present life I shall be in horrible difficulties. I have a tiny income of my own, but I'm afraid it's badly invested, for it seems to bring in less every year, and I am so ignorant of money matters that I don't know if my aunt's agent, who looks after it, is a good advisor. She paused a moment and added in a lighter tone, I didn't mean to bore you with all this, but I want your help in making Judy understand that I can't, at present, go on living as one must live among you all. I am going away tomorrow to join my aunt at Richfield, and I shall stay there for the rest of the autumn, and dismiss my maid, and learn how to mend my own clothes. At this picture of loveliness in distress, the pathos of which was heightened by the light touch with which it was drawn, a murmur of indignant sympathy broke from Treanor. 24 hours earlier, if his wife had consulted him on the subject of Miss Bart's future, he would have said that a girl with extravagant tastes and no money had better marry the first rich man she could get. But with the subject of DISP 87 greater than cushion at his side, turning to him for sympathy, making him feel that he understood her better than her dearest friends, and confirming the assurance by the appeal of her exquisite nearness. He was ready to swear that such a marriage was a desecration, and that, as a man of honor, he was bound to do all he could to protect her from the results of her disinterestedness. This impulse was reinforced by the reflection that if S. he had married Grice, she would have been surrounded by flattery and approval, whereas, having refused to sacrifice herself to expediency, she was left to bear the whole cost of her resistance. Hang it, if he could find a way out of such difficulties for a professional sponge like Carrie Fisher, who was simply a mental habit corresponding to the physical titillations of the cigarette or the cocktail, he could surely do as much for a girl who appealed to his highest sympathies, and who brought her troubles to him with the trustfulness of a child. Trina and Miss Bart prolonged their drive till long after sunset, and before it was over he had tried, with some show of success, to prove to her that, if she would only trust him, he could make a handsome sum of money for her without endangering the small amount she possessed. She was too genuinely ignorant of the manipulations of the stock market to understand his technical explanations, or even perhaps to perceive that certain points in them were slurred. The haziness enveloping the transaction served as a veil for her embarrassment, and through the general blur her hopes dilated like lamps in a fog. She understood only that her modest investments were to be mysteriously multiplied without risk to herself, and the assurance that this miracle would take place within a short time, that there would be no tedious interval for suspense and reaction, relieved her of her lingering scruples. Again she felt the lightening of her load, and with it the release of repressed activities. Her immediate worries conjured, it was easy to resolve that she would never again find herself in such straits, and as the need of economy and self-denial receded from her foreground, she felt herself ready to meet any other demand which life might make. Even the immediate one of letting Trina, as they drove homeward, lean a little nearer, and rest his hand reassuringly on hers, cost her only a momentary shiver of reluctance. It was part of the game to make him feel that her appeal had been an uncalculated impulse, provoked by the liking he inspired, and the renewed sense of power in handling men, while it consoled her wounded vanity, helped also to obscure the thought of the claim at which his manner hinted. He was a coarse, dull man who, under all his show of authority, was a mere supernumerary in the costly show for which his money paid. Surely, to a clever girl, it would be easy to hold him by his vanity, and so keep the obligation on his side. The first $1,000 check which Lily received with a blotted scrawl from Gus Trainer strengthened her self-confidence in the exact degree to which it effaced her debts. The transaction had justified itself by its results. She saw now how absurd it would have been to let any primitive scruple deprive her of this easy means of appeasing her creditors. Lily felt really virtuous as she dispensed the sum in sops to her tradesmen, and the fact that a fresh order accompanied each payment did not lessen her sense of disinterestedness. How many women, in her place, would have given the orders without making the payment? S. he had found it reassuringly easy to keep Trina in a good humor, to listen to his stories, to receive his confidences and laugh at his jokes, seemed for the moment all that was required of her, and the complacency with which her hostess regarded these attentions freed them of the least hint of ambiguity. Mrs. Trina evidently assumed that Lily's growing intimacy with her husband was simply an indirect way of returning her own kindness. "I'm so glad you and Gus have become such good friends," she said approvingly. "It's too delightful of you to be so nice to him, and put up with all his tiresome stories. I know what they are, because I had to listen to them when we were engaged. I'm sure he is telling the same one still. And now I shan't always have to be asking Carrie Fisher here to keep him in a good humor. She's a perfect vulture, you know, and as he hasn't the least moral sense. She is always getting Gus to speculate for her, and I'm sure she never pays when she loses. Miss Bart could shudder at this state of things without the embarrassment of a personal application. Her own position was surely quite different. There could be no question of her not paying when she lost, since Treanor had assured her that she was certain not to lose. In sending her the check, he had explained that he had made 5,000 for her out of Rosedale's IP, and had put 4,000 back in the same venture, as there was the promise of another IG rise. She understood, therefore, that he was now speculating with her own money, and that she consequently owed him no more than the gratitude which such a trifling service demanded. She vaguely supposed that, to raise the first sum, he had borrowed on her securities. But this was a point over which her curiosity did not linger. It was concentrated, for the moment, on the probable date of the next big rise. The news of this event was received by her some weeks later, on the occasion of Jack Stepney's marriage to Miss Van Osburgh. As a cousin of the bridegroom, Miss Bart had been asked to act as bridesmaid. But as he had declined on the plea that, since she was much taller than the other attendant virgins, her presence might mar the symmetry of the group. The truth was, as he had attended too many brides to the altar. When next seen there, she meant to be the chief figure in the ceremony. She knew the pleasantries made at the expense of young girls who have been too long before the public, and she was resolved to avoid such assumptions of youthfulness as might lead people to think her older than she really was. The Van Osburgh marriage was celebrated in the village church near the paternal estate on the Hudson. It was the Impel country wedding to which guests are convoyed in special trains, and from which the hordes of the uninvited have to be fended off by the intervention of the police. While these sylvan rites were taking place, in a church packed with fashion and festooned with orchids, the representatives of the press were threading their way, notebook in hand, through the labyrinth of wedding presents, and the agent of a cinematograph syndicate was setting up his apparatus at the church door. It was the kind of scene in which Lily had often pictured herself as taking the principal part, and on this occasion the fact that she was once more merely a casual spectator, instead of the mystically veiled figure occupying the center of attention, strengthened her resolve to assume the latter part before the year was over. The fact that her immediate anxieties were relieved did not blind her to a possibility of their recurrence. It merely gave her enough buoyancy to rise once more above her doubts and feel a renewed faith in her beauty, her power, and her general fitness to attract a brilliant destiny. It could not be that one conscious of such aptitudes for mastery and enjoyment was doomed to a perpetuity of failure, and her mistakes looked easily reparable in the light of her restored self-confidence. A special appositeness was given to these reflections by the discovery, in a neighboring pew, of the serious profile and neatly trimmed beard of Mr. Percy Gryce. There was something almost bridal in his own aspect. His large white gardenia had a symbolic air that struck Lily as a good omen. After all, seen in an assemblage of his kind, he was not ridiculous looking. A friendly critic might have called his heaviness weighty, and he was at his best in the attitude of vacant passivity which brings out the oddities of the restless. She fancied he was the kind of man whose sentimental associations would be stirred by the conventional imagery of a wedding, and she pictured herself, in the seclusion of the Van Osburgh conservatories, playing skillfully upon sensibilities thus prepared for her touch. In fact, when she looked at the other women about her, and recalled the images he had brought away from her own glass, it did not seem as though any special skill would be needed to repair her blunder, and bring him once more to her feet. The sight of Selden's dark head, in a pew almost facing her, disturbed for a moment the balance of her complacency. The rise of her blood as their eyes met was succeeded by a contrary motion, a wave of resistance and withdrawal. She did not wish to see him again, not because she feared his influence, but because his presence always had the effect of cheapening her aspirations, of throwing her whole world out of focus. Besides, he was a living reminder of the worst mistake in her career, and the fact that he had been its cause did not soften her feelings toward him. She could still imagine an ideal state of existence in which, all else being superadded, intercourse with Selden might be the last touch of luxury. But in the world as it was, such a privilege was likely to cost more than it was worth. Lily, dear, I never saw you look so lovely. You look as if something delightful had just happened to you. The young lady who thus formulated her admiration of her brilliant friend did not, in her own person, suggest such happy possibilities. Miss Gertrude Farish, in fact, typified the mediocre and the ineffectual. If there were compensating qualities in her white frank glance, and the freshness of her smile, these were qualities which only the sympathetic observer would perceive, before noticing that her eyes were of a workaday gray, and her lips without haunting curves. Lily's own view of her wavered between pity for her limitations and impatience at her cheerful acceptance of them. To Miss Bart, as to her mother, acquiescence in dinginess was evidence of stupidity. And there were moments when, in the consciousness of her own power to look, and to be so, exactly what the occasion required, she almost felt that other girls were plain, and inferior from choice. Certainly no one need have confessed such acquiescence in her lot as was revealed in the seafull color of Gertie Farish's gown, and the subdued lines of her hat. It is almost as stupid to let your clothes betray that you know you are ugly, as to have them proclaim that you think you are beautiful. Of course, being fatally poor and dingy, it was wise of Gertie to have taken up philanthropy and symphony concerts. But there was something irritating in her assumption that existence yielded no higher pleasures, and that one might get as much interest and excitement out of life in a cramped flat as in the splendors of the Van Osburgh establishment. Today, however, her chirping enthusiasms did not irritate Lily. They seemed only to throw her own exceptionalness into becoming relief, and give a soaring vastness to her scheme of life. Do let us go, and take a peep at the presents, before everyone else leaves the dining room, suggested Miss Farish, linking her arm in her friend's. It was characteristic of her to take a sentimental, and an envious interest in all the details of a wedding. She was the kind of person who always kept her handkerchief out during the service, and departed clutching a box of wedding cake. Isn't everything beautifully done? She pursued, as they entered the distant drawing room assigned to the display of Miss Van Osburgh's bridal spoils. I always say no one does things better than Cousin Grace. Did you ever taste anything more delicious than that mousse of lobster with champagne sauce? I made up my mind weeks ago that I wouldn't miss this wedding, and just fancy how delightfully it all came about. When Lawrence Selden heard I was coming, he insisted on fetching me himself and... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.